top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
I had an imaginary friend when I was a kid. His name was Daniel, and he was my best friend.
Did something happen with this friend?
No.
Something painful?
No. Just kid stuff.
What did you do? What did you do to me?
It's common for people to see things that aren't real. You shouldn't be afraid of your imagination.
You're something so much more interesting.
What's that thing behind me?
Your shadow.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here is episode 384 of the Really Awful Movies Podcast. Daniel Isn't Real from 2019. This one is just full of Jungian elements, and particularly when it comes to the aspect of one's persona that doesn't jive with how you're trying to live a moral life, and that would be the shadow. And that's kind of the anxiety and repression and disunity of your psyche as a whole. And this is terrifically explored in this film, and it uses the conceit of an imaginary friend, which is something that the horror realm has exploited to a great deal through a variety of films. When you think of, let's say, the Christian Bale star, The Machinist, where he becomes increasingly emaciated and his mind is kind of torn asunder, and he turns to a figment of his imagination. I forget the character's name, but there's numerous examples. Of course, Danny Torrance in The Shining, and a terrific example that will particularly resonate with you if you have a child would be the imaginary friend from the Ethan Hawke star called Sinister, which compels his young daughter to create these very, very grotesque, almost De Goya-esque scribblings that is really impactful. I'm not sure how I would react, being a relatively new father myself, if my son were to produce such images. It was really compelling, but it even got to me before fatherhood in a very impactful way. There's of course Captain Howdy from The Exorcist, but what we get in Daniel Isn't Real is more in keeping with the kind of splits and the division of personality that you get from David Cronenberg's twin film with Jeremy Irons, Dead Ringers, in more of the sense that the dramatic dyad that twosome provides creates, I think, in a similar dynamic, the devil on one shoulder, and you have the different personality types, Elliot and Bev, and to the extent that they share the same genetics, they still have significantly different personalities, and one is definitely in the driver's seat and calling all the shots. And it's just a terrific wellspring of ideas that this can lend itself to. And I think in this one here, it really is explored with a lot of great depth and a lot of concision, much appreciated, and for the first 45 minutes at least, I thought a really impactful means of telling a story. Always appreciate something, apologies here for the first responders, been just constant deluge of police and fire lately, but I always appreciate a film lensed in New York And it's always good to see the city come alive, especially in the horror space. I'm thinking back to 2007's Murder Party, which was filmed, I think, in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, as this one was in part as well, and which involved this nebbishy kind of introverted nerd who basically finds a poster, an invite, and happens upon this artist collective who play games with him. It's a terrific comedy horror. It's well worth checking out. And actually, I was at a bar around Halloween a couple of years back, and someone dressed as the protagonist from the film. And I thought, man, that's really, really niche. And it's something that's really genius. But again, New York City coming alive is great. You got the likes of Taxi Driver, not exactly a horror, but Driller Killer, Maniac, stuff that's set in Brooklyn, that's always good. Always like a nice urban milieu to set a horror film. And so what you have is Luke and Daniel. Luke is the protagonist, and he has experiences this childhood trauma where he witnesses some shooting that leaves one of his neighbors in a pool of blood on her front stoop. And the titular Daniel from Daniel Isn't Real, I mean, is played by Patrick Schwarzenegger, who cuts quite a unique figure, and he's unmistakable in terms of his jawline and his eyes from his iconic father. But he brings with it a very devilish, but I think comedic aspect to the role that I think really puts this into another gear. I mean, there are elements of this. It's a quite good performance. There are elements of it that are maybe Shakespearean, from Midsummer Night's Dream, maybe Puck. So there's a playful devilishness and a deep underlying evil that he really brings to the table. So post witnessing this traumatic event, Luke conjures up, as many a child will do, an imaginary friend with whom he plays, engages in swashbuckling sword play, and hangs out and plays with his toys. And at one point, his mother admonishes him for making this kid up, then just basically relents and just accepts this delusion and begins to engage with Daniel as if he is real, and brings him over to the house. And that it's quite a good interplay between the characters, and you get to also get a sense of how Luke's mother is coming apart at the seams too. I was thinking, speaking of Cronenberg too, that the depiction of mental illness in film can be quite tricky, and with Cronenberg in the underseen, I think, and somewhat underappreciated Spider, he really, which I own, I've watched a couple times, it's a really difficult watch. As the title would suggest, the fraying at the seams and mental breakdown is manifested in that film as a spider web, and unable to break free from this trap in a very enclosed space in a room. And in the case of Daniel Isn't Real, it's what you have is a very, down the drain, right? Drain being referenced to, liminal space between purgatory, like between heaven and hell, and going down. I mean, lots of religions associate the netherworld and the underworld with evil, and so you get this drain motif going through, and it's almost this Fibonacci sequence, but not quite. You have these swirls going around. It's almost like a galaxy. It's almost unending, but it's a way to depict the spiral that characters are going on very literally. So you get that happening, and the mother is totally come apart at the seams. And when I was watching this, I was thinking, really, she should be institutionalized, because someone like that couldn't adequately care for themselves. And this is someone who lives probably on the Upper East Side. This is one of those brownstones, very posh, very Manhattan rich. And you can get a sense of how she's really come apart by how she writes all these notes. And she takes passages out of novels, and if they're particularly impactful to her, she scribbles them down or rips them out. And so she's got these collage and expurgated clips of a little bit of text, and it's strewn all over the place, and she breaks glass, and And well, I mean, the glass as a motif for mental illness and as something that doesn't wholly represent what is seen. I think that was that's pretty intriguing as well. So you get the mother really coming apart, and then the son having to come to terms with that while also dealing with his own trauma and being a undergraduate student and also being under the care of an attendant psychologist, Dr. Brown. And that's a really, really great character. And this is where, I guess, the through some discussions through psychotherapy, again, the Jungian theme writ large through actual psychotherapy as well, you have the clinician actually inviting Luke to interface with his demons. What the psychologist actually says is modern day parlance for what we would call traumas, to actually interface with those by engaging actively with Daniel, with the devil on his shoulder. And I couldn't think of a worse advice, as we soon find out. And at the onset, we get a sense of how the duality plays out, and how the good and evil, life and death, and well, what Jung called the shadow really comes to be, and how at the onset, much like addiction, you get a high, and then you get a concomitant low that is almost the opposite. So at the outset, you get Daniel being a fellow traveler, in his words, who is able to, I would even say he's maybe the ultimate wingman, who's able to assist Luke with all the dealings that you have when you're an undergraduate. And in the case of being a a virile young man, you're going after women and you're going after, trying to hook up. And he has this wingman of Daniel who's able to, at a moment's notice, to snatch from the air, from the ether, little snippets and neologisms and witticisms and quotes that he can, that Luke can then use to bed down with co-eds. And you get this sense of just how powerful and how dangerous this part of your persona would be. So it's something that we all have and to various extents repress and bring to light, but it's not altogether a sinister or dark, or wholly sinister or dark force, according to Jung anyway. But as the film progresses, Daniel isn't real, goes to show and goes to reveal that it can be to Luke's detriment to be so engaged with this this advocate, almost this spiritual advocate. And this happens when he goes to our art showings. He goes out to Brooklyn and meets up with this young artist who, in this quite pivotal scene, asks Luke to disrobe and tries to paint him, and actually makes his shadow real through a collection of devilish horns that are very, very subtle. It could also be like a fence or some sort of barrier, and a psychological barrier. And this is a reflection of the issues that Luke is actually going through himself. You see this painting that she is able to see, as I suppose the best art always does, the reality behind the real. So the two of them connect, but with the continued goading of Daniel, he pursues other relationships, and he says, "You know, you're not married to this woman. Go, go, go." He meets this woman who looks like a 1920s kind of a flapper actress, and he name drops Louise Brooks, quotes German expressionism film, and is basically this able to generate. It's almost like a chess player cheating with an earpiece. He's able to really become whole through his other half in a way, and he's able to say what other people intend to hear. And this is a really, really great dynamic, because it's something that people should be able to keep in check if they're spiritually whole and if they are well adjusted. They should be able to take these signs that we perpetually experience and either repress them when needed or deal with them at face value when you can. So I just love that dynamic. I love the first 50 minutes of this movie, where you get really, really nice visuals and nice depictions of mental illness, the dynamism and the dynamic between Luke and Daniel. And they're biblical references, but nothing brings, neither of which brings forth anything that I can, other than like the synoptic gospels of Luke, obviously, and Daniel from the Old Testament. But there's the way that I think it's just arbitrary how they were named, unless I'm really missing something on the religious side of things. But I just thought that the beginning was really dynamite, and it almost reminded me in part of Hereditary, which also makes incredible use of a diorama. So what you have is Luke, who's trying to engage with Daniel and trying to, I guess, limit him in some sense, and try and is able to do this through the threshold of a doorway into a home, and which represents really a repression. So he is able to actually lock up this person, and is able to, for a time anyway, until he encounters stresses and engages with his clinician, then he's able to release him from this trap, and the two of them really, push one and goad one another on. And that's, I thought that was really, really cool. It was a great metaphor of something being under lock and key. I really like that. I really like the safety element of the home as your dwelling place, and it's supposed to be a place from which you're safe from the difficulties and the vicissitudes of the outside world. I thought that was really, really dynamite. Relationship between the young artist, this is played by Sasha Lane, and I apologize, I'm not really keen on these kind of men in tights superhero movies, but she's this dreadlocked actress who was in Loki, I believe. I'm not familiar with any other aspects of her work, but my God, like the love she has and the way that she hit it off immediately with Luke was something very, very touching. And he actually is coerced and cajoled into claiming that he's a photographer in order to get in her good graces, because she's a quite a prolific painter and probably sees herself as some sort of Basquiat type figure living in this, well, very Basquiat-esque actually, Brooklyn loft. I don't know how she affords this as an undergraduate, but Daniel sort of presses Luke into saying that he's a photographer, which actually gets Luke into photography. So he buys an old-timey camera and tries to capture what he is seeing and what his shadow and what the devil on his shoulder is seeing. And that part's quite good too. You have this dynamic where he starts to hit it off with this new woman that he met and seduces at a party. They go into this tunnel, and again, this portal to an underworld. This is terrific images, and this kind of, as urban explorers, they cross this threshold into the darkness. They go around, and they have this, the sexual relations that he has with this woman at the time is really very impactful too, because you have almost an 80s body switcheroo thing happening between Luke and Daniel, where he just pulls apart Luke's jaw and basically enters into him to make his incomplete self whole, almost. They basically swap persona and swap bodies and swap outlooks and swap psychologies, and that's dynamite as well. Toward the end, things sort of run out of gas from a narrative perspective, because there's not really enough happening as things, as you become, it becomes clear that Luke is not benefiting from this what was a symbiotic, decent and helpful relationship, and it becomes one that becomes more parasitic in nature. And those are not my words, but words he uses when there's ultimately a tete-a-tete atop a Brooklyn warehouse. And that also revives and is a reprieve of their swashbuckling, almost like an Errol Flynn type of sword fighting that you have in the first few scenes, but it's brought to bear when they're both adults and you have this battle with the psyche that takes place where you have these two competing impulses that work on the collective, according to Jung, but also personally, and trying to keep down and beat down one or the other. And there's also imagery used using bricks as a way, as a barrier. I mean, it's literally when you put up a barrier to someone, it's something that you would rather not address. And this is something that is made visually manifest when it's a way to separate the Sasha Lane character, the artist, from Luke. And then he has to battle back to break down the walls and get into her good graces and to gain her acceptance. Because once he's taken over by Daniel, things get ugly really quick and he threatens her life, and it's up to Luke to save her life and save himself. So really intriguing stuff, a little bit gimmicky, but still like a wealth of things to chew on psychologically, philosophically. This almost has more in common with Being John Malkovich and Dead Ringers than it does some of the other kinds of imaginary friend films, because those largely, these movies have a component that involves children and manifest this idea as a something that is usually outgrown by the time childhood ends, which is typically the case. So the fact that the machinist does this is in some way unique, but in the horror space it's something that little kids usually embody, and it's something that is very impactful when it's done with them. And the fact that it's done here is really cool. And the filmmaker also, I mean, he's obviously studied a lot of Bergman. You get these face two shots that he must have watched The Seventh Seal or something, but you have these little flourishes, you have really nice visuals, you have really good performances, particularly Patrick Schwarzenegger as the Daniel character, who is ultimately tasked with the most challenging effort, because he has to be engaging and superficially glib and charming at the beginning, but then he has to finally, I guess, descend into evil. And so he's got a really challenging role, but he really steps to the forefront and really gives it his all. And I really like a lot of aspects of this film. I mean, a clinician's involvement is particularly good, especially when he finally encounters both Luke and Daniel and realizes that Daniel is not really a figment of Luke's imagination, but is actually an evil figure in his own right. And another thing I learned was that there's, when I got a chance to visit the Benelux countries, I guess what they call Belgium, Netherlands, and Luxembourg. I mean, this is where you can see Hieronymus Bosch triptychs and paintings and whatnot. And there's a little flourish of that kind of imagery of one of the famous Bosch paintings and how he really depicted hell. And there's lots of hellish depictions in this. Again, whether it's the, sewer that the urban explorers explore, or whether it's just, you know, an opening up into this portal. It's almost Lucio Fulcian portal with this, I think it's City of the Living Dead, that has this wall that is broken through in the basement that leads to a portal to hell. It's just full of this kind of great imagery. The performances are pretty top drawer. I think they could have cut a few scenes from it, but I really liked what was going on in this. For the first 50 minutes, for sure, I would give this 4.5 star, and then things sort of somewhat petered out, but the visuals are just outstanding. I mean, there's one in particular where the artist's girlfriend, and I want to say her name's Cassie, she's scaling a wall, and she's descending this wall, and it's this converted warehouse space, and she is on this ladder, and you get this amazing vista of the two examples of the dueling psychological personas, Daniel and Luke, the dramaturgical dyad battling on top, and then her climbing down to the bottom. And it's this wide shot that's really elegantly, really well crafted, and really well put together. Yeah, you could say, I don't know if truth be told, I was wholly sold on Miles Robbins as the Luke character, who suffers a lot of social anxiety and who has to deal with his mother at home. And I don't think I was in wholly invested in his character, and he of course, given that his mother is schizophrenic, he is pursuing all these angles about what he thinks could be happening to him and whether he's doomed by genetics to experience the exact same thing, because to a large extent mental illness is heritable. I think it's like a 0.4 or something, a correlation for schizophrenia, but I could be wrong. But I think, though, that ultimately his dynamic with Schwarzenegger is actually quite good, though I would have liked a little bit more of a performance that's a little more out of Miles Robbins, but I think that's splitting hairs a little bit. Another thing I learned, this was part produced by Elijah Wood, which is interesting. He's one of four producers, and obviously he must be a fan of the horror space. I mean, it's quite rare that you get a remake of an iconic horror property from the 80s that's done well. And I thought his Maniac from 2012 was actually quite good, even though they decamped from Brooklyn, New York to Los Angeles, which I don't find as impactful, just nearly as much of a gritty urban setting that I like to see for the likes of, you know, like a Street Trash or that kind of thing. I like my urban settings more gritty, although who knows, maybe you could set something, especially nowadays, in Los Angeles' Skid Row. But he's one of the producers here, and I think this one's very worth your while. I'd be a little, I think, reticent about giving this 4-star because I think there is a little bit of narrative sag that happens toward the end. And but I mean, you got to give credit where credit's due. Lots of good practical effects, a terrific idea, and surprising the extent to which this got wider distribution, because this is kind of an art house concept, but it's not imbued with art house an overarching art house sensibility. So I think it's more accessible than the likes of a Saint Maud or something like that, or a Titan. I think it's way more intuitive and way more easy for audiences to swallow. And I think and yet has a lot much more going on behind the scenes, as it were, than would meet the eye. So terrific. 3.75 for me out of 5 on this one. I think it's well worth your while. And it's possible that I did watch this in two halves, so it's possible that, you know, I want to check my own biases here as a critic, that I could have been not in the right headspace to continue on. I think it's best to see films in their entirety through one shot, but sometimes you just get tired and you can't do so. But I thought this was well worth all the approbation sent its way, and as I hope my podcast is. Continue to listen. Oh, and a quick shout out to Nikki from Baltimore, a friend of mine is really cool, and who engaged with my site through an Imaginary Friends and Horror Films post that I did, but also an associated podcast. So really cool. Thanks for listening. Thanks to the broader public for listening too. Really appreciate y'all, wherever you happen to be listening from. And we'll talk to you soon. Take care. Thank you.